I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A day after tens of thousands of Lebanese protested in the streets of Beirut against Syrian troop occupation, 200,000 pro-Syrian demonstrators gathered in the Lebanese capital today to protest U.S. interference. We'll have more from Beirut in a moment. But first, speaking before an appreciative audience at the National Defense University in Washington, President Bush delivered a terrorism update today, vowing to fight tyranny worldwide in order to end terrorism against and in the U.S., and he focused on fostering democracy in the Middle East.
The advance of hope in the Middle East requires new thinking in the region. By now, it should be clear that authoritarian rule is not the wave of the future. It is the last gasp of a discredited past.
The president promised to stay on the offensive against terrorism until the fight is won, or in his words, as long as it takes. His comments come as foreign leaders are meeting for a four-day anti-terrorism conference in Madrid, where the Brazilian president warned that unilateral responses to terrorism were inadequate and risky. Well, joining us on the line from Washington is Faye Bowers, national security correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Faye, first, your impression of the speech.
Well, except for the stronger focus on promoting democracy and freedom in the Middle East especially, I thought it was much the same as his policy laid out in the National Strategy for Combating Terrorism that the White House presented in February 2003.
Well, he spoke of his immediate strategy in the war on terror. What is that?
That's sort of, you know, bringing the fight to the terrorists before they bring it to us, which is, you know, also a continuation of his policy of the past. He thinks, you know, if we keep the terrorists busy trying to dodge death and capture, that they're not as free to launch attacks on the United States as they otherwise would be.
And by the way, some analysis from you. Is that something that security experts you speak with agree will make the U.S. safer?
Well, I think, you know, most security and analysts that I speak with and intelligence experts say, you know, that the United States government, along with some very important allies, especially European and Middle East allies, have certainly made a dent in al-Qaeda and other terror groups and have certainly vanquished some of their leadership. But, you know, as the president mentioned today, they are still out there, and their goal is still as strong as today as it was 3.5 years ago, and that is to strike the United States on its own soil.
Well, let's hear a little more from the speech today, in which President Bush characterized some of the changes on the ground in the Middle East.
Many people in the region have deeply ingrained habits of fear. For all these reasons, the chances of democratic progress in the broader Middle East have seemed frozen in place for decades. Yet at last, clearly and suddenly, the thaw has begun.
Faye Bowers, many would say the president is right with elections in different parts of the region, but in a moment we're going to go to Beirut, where thousands of anti-U.S. protesters called by Hezbollah, gathered in Syria. So it might not have felt like much of a thaw there. Do you think the president was mindful of that in speaking directly to the opposition?
I think so. I think, you know, he had some very strong comments for the Syrian leaders, for the leaders in Iran especially, and pointed particularly at leaving Lebanon and how clearly the United States and other allies were standing with Lebanon in its search for freedom. But as you mentioned, you know, the protests in Beirut today are attended by many more people than the pro-withdrawal protests in the past few days.
Mm-hmm, the opposition. Well, the president also delivered this, as some have called it, this catch-up or, you know, heads-up on terror speech. On International Women's Day, he spoke of the full participation of women in Middle East countries, and he linked economic progress to political modernization. Your sense of how that's resonating, obviously you haven't spoken to people yet, his speech just happened today, but how is that likely to resonate?
That's right. Well, you know, interestingly, the Saudi embassy here had a speech yesterday talking about the progress they're making in their country. And as you mentioned, President Bush today heralded all the progress that's been made in places like Afghanistan, Iraq, the Palestinian territories, and now Lebanon. But he also heralded, like, the small steps that countries like Saudi Arabia in Egypt have taken. But he also said, you know, much more is needed. And he talked about the municipal elections that were recently held in Saudi Arabia, but they need much more participation, like participation by women.
Faye Bowers, National Security Correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Thank you so much. We'll be speaking to you again.
My pleasure.
Well, as we said, many tens of thousands of people gathered in Beirut today in support of Syria in a rally called for by Hezbollah, the militant group that's attempting to transform itself into a political faction and has been quiet during 2 weeks of opposition protest against Syria. Joining us from Beirut is Hassan Fatah of The New York Times. Hassan, how big was the crowd?
It was certainly a massive crowd, 200,000 at least. It stretched for many, many miles. In fact, it was a show of force that there's a dramatic group of people that has been left out.
And by the way, by comparison, the anti-Syrian crowds have attracted how many people?
By comparison, maybe 50,000 at the biggest.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, what this was Hezbollah showing that it can bring out the numbers of a demonstration in support of Syria, but just as importantly, against UN Resolution 1559, which ultimately would disarm Hezbollah. In a way, it's an attempt to reach out to the opposition movement and to basically say, we understand that you have this problem and that you need to basically deal with 1559 because it's a reality, and this is the way you can deal with it. It's a legalistic answer more than anything else, and it's a very interesting way of dealing with it. If you call us a resistance movement rather than a militia, we don't fall under the purview of 1559.
What else were the leaders of Hezbollah saying at this rally?
They did two things that were very, very important. They did not allow any political flags,
mm-hmm.
and just as important, they made very sure to not allow the crowd to move over to the opposition camp out at the Martyrs Square. They certainly did not want confrontation and were very, very careful about that. One of the more important things they were emphasizing, as Hezbollah's head, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, said, is that Lebanon is not Ukraine, Lebanon is not Georgia. Speaking largely to the sense of the opposition movement emulating Ukraine's democratic revolution and things like that.
Just a little bit of context here. Hezbollah, as we know, means Party of God. It was founded in the 80s by Iran as a paramilitary terrorist group. Why are they able to get so many people out? Is it at the point of a gun or because they also provide useful services for people?
Hezbollah is a remarkably well-organized group. They offer social services. They offer various things that the Lebanese government either was not able to or has not, especially to Lebanon's impoverished south and Beirut's southern suburbs. As a result, it's endeared itself to many of its followers and is seen as a very central group. The rally was peaceful, but it was at the same time rambunctious.
I'm curious, were men and women, for instance, kept separate?
Not really, actually, and that's one of the more interesting things about this. It's not necessarily unusual for Hezbollah. After all, their media office is right upstairs from a lingerie shop. It's not necessarily what you would imagine. Not everyone was in hijab, not everyone was completely covered up, and it was a rather interesting and mixed crowd. And that was the thing that they were trying to emphasize. The dramatic difference between this demonstration and the other demonstrations of the opposition movement is largely a class difference. I mean, it was clear that this group was much more of a working class group. They were certainly people from Lebanon suburbs rather than from its more shishi parts of town. They were certainly people who had not didn't drive BMWs, and in fact, many of them came in buses and were bussed in.
Yeah. Hassan Fatah, reporter for The New York Times, speaking to us from Beirut, Lebanon. Hassan, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, we turn now to Flint Leverett. He's an expert in the region who's held senior positions at the National Security Council, the CIA, and the State Department. He's now a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution's Saban Center for Middle East Policy and the author of the soon-to-be-released book, Inheriting Syria, Bashar's Trial by Fire. Flint, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
And you wrote in an op-ed piece in the New York Times entitled Don't Rush on the Road to Damascus that the U.S. should be careful what you wish for. What is the cautionary flag that you're raising about the U.S. wanting Syria out perhaps too quickly from Lebanon? What could the ramifications be?
I think there are two that we really need to focus on. One is a risk of conflict inside Lebanon. As we're seeing today, Hezbollah is going to be a force to be reckoned with in this process. But the fact remains that when Hezbollah blew up the Marine Corps barracks in Beirut in 1983, more American servicemen died in that incident than in any other single incident since the Second World War. This is, while it is a very powerful and important political force in Lebanon, it also remains the world's most capable terrorist organization. Now, do we really want to see a Lebanese political order in which Hezbollah is taken into the government, in which there are Hezbollah ministers, in which Hezbollah has even more political power and influence and prestige than it has now?
Because Syria Act is sort of a limiter on Hezbollah.
Yes, that's correct. Alternatively, do we want to set in motion a process where if Hezbollah is frustrated, if Hezbollah is shut out, with the kind of support on the street that it is showing it has today, do we really want Hezbollah acting to defend its position and possibly sparking a reemergence of sectarian violence in Lebanon? I don't think that's in our interest either. And then I also think that it is a mistake to believe that we should use this issue of Syrian hegemony in Lebanon as a lever for trying to bring about the downfall of the Syrian regime. We have seen before in the region the unintended consequences that can come if you bring down an Arab regime and don't really have a very clear plan for what comes after.
It's like pulling out a pickup stick and the whole pile of sticks might go. You write that even Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's national security advisor said that Syria leaving too quickly could pose a threat to Israel.
Yes. I mean, the Israelis are not necessarily opposed to getting Syria out of Lebanon, but they certainly don't want this to precipitate instability and chaos on their northern border.
And how important is it to U.S. interests to have President Assad stay in office? I mean, it's been said that if he's too humiliated and if the power brokers in Syria get angry about the power they're losing in Lebanon with the withdrawal, he could topple.
That argument has been made, and I think there are some in the administration for whom that is part of the plan. They would like to see this regime in Damascus brought down. As I indicated, I think that that is a mistake. We don't know what the alternative would be if the Assad regime collapsed. My strong suspicion, though, that out of the chaos that would follow, the most likely alternative to emerge is going to be heavily Islamist. And it's not really clear to me how that advances U.S. interests in the region at this point.
Flint Leverett is a senior fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He's also author of the upcoming book on Syrian President Bashar Assad. It's called Inheriting Syria, Bashar's Trial by Fire. Flint, thanks so much.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Just ahead, why Bill Gates calls high schools obsolete and how he's putting his money where his mouth is. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We all know about the three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic, but here's a different interpretation.
A challenging curriculum, an interesting course of study, and a supportive environment. We call that rigor, relevance, and relationship.
That's Tom Vander Ark, who heads up education for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Last month, the Gates Foundation announced it will give $15 million to help improve public high schools in the U.S. And in making the announcement, Bill Gates, the CEO of Microsoft, said high schools had become obsolete. Well, we spoke to Tom Vander Ark to ask, why does Bill Gates feel that way?
He used the term obsolete to imply that they're not broken. People are working harder than they ever have, and in some respects, our high schools are working better than they ever have. There's more students taking more rigorous courses, so there's a lot to be proud of. But our high schools were never designed to help all students leave with a quality education, ready for 21st century family wage jobs and for further learning after high school. They were designed to sort and select, and they do so ruthlessly well.
What do you mean, sort and select?
Well, it starts in middle school, and I really learned this as a parent as much as a superintendent, that some students do well in sixth grade math, and then they get honors math in seventh grade, and then they get algebra in eighth grade. Only about 25% of American kids take algebra in eighth grade, and then those students are on their way. They'll get a college prep high school curriculum or an advanced college prep full of international baccalaureate or advanced placement courses, and the others will muddle through a general track or a vocational track or worse. So the top 15 or 20% of American kids are getting the best education in the world, and low-income and minority students, unfortunately, are typically not in that category. And so many of them drop out, or if they do get a degree, they're not at all ready for college or work.
How do you change that? How do you make those kids that didn't do well in that first math class do well?
There's two strategies we encourage districts to take on. One is to start new schools, and Boston is a great example of that. They have 17 pilot schools in Boston. These are kind of in-district charter schools. They're given a high level of autonomy, and those schools were designed around this premise of helping all students succeed at a high level. So that's the first strategy. The second strategy is to redesign the secondary schools so that every student is engaged in a rigorous curriculum in a well-supported environment.
We understand a curriculum that's interdisciplinary and relevant to current events. Well, how do you do that? I mean, do you just put rap music in the courses? Because, teachers do that.
There are several strategies. So we think of three different kinds of schools: academic schools and thematic schools and alternative schools. Academic schools just build a very powerful college-bound culture. The second group of schools have a particular theme, and that might be occupational, or it might be leadership or the arts. Boston Arts High School is a great example of that. The last kind of school, alternative schools, are very small, highly supportive, and individualized. And many of those schools, like the Med in Providence, will help a student develop an individualized learning plan. So we think every city ought to develop a portfolio of these kinds of options so that students, instead of choosing from a phone book size catalog of courses, can choose schools that would meet their needs and interests.
Thomas Vander Ark, Executive Director again of Education at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. A daunting project, you know, to completely revamp American high schools. Have you seen it work?
We have now co-sponsored over 800 new schools, and half of them are open today. I went to three last week in three of the toughest neighborhoods in America. In those neighborhoods, about 5 or 6% of the young people would have had a chance to complete a college degree. And I visited these schools that I'm confident will see more than 80% of the students graduate, and I think we'll see 50 or 60% of the students from those schools graduating with a college degree. That's a tenfold improvement in probable life outcomes, from 5% to 50%.
And that's astonishing. And you know someone's going to hear that and say, you are dreaming. I mean,
you can go to Boston Arts or to Fenway, and you'll see average Boston kids, at least half of them are going to finish a college degree. And if that group of pilot schools didn't exist, you'd have what has become typical at 5 or 6% of low-income urban kids.
Thomas Vander Ark is Executive Director of Education at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. He spoke to us from Seattle. Tom, thanks very much.
Thanks so much.
And okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, we will visit one of the pilot high schools supported with funds from the Gates Foundation, Tech Boston Academy. It's small. It's just 3 years old. It's housed with two other high schools in what used to be one massive public high. And students like junior Karen Thomas love it.
I'm trying to keep up my grades so I can get a scholarship for college. And I couldn't do that. It would be impossible without the teacher's help. Like, if I stay after school and the teachers are willing to be there and to help you. So it's There's no way. It would be impossible.
Have you been in a larger school, a larger population school?
Middle school. It was a big middle school. So this was kind of, in the beginning, it was a setback. I was so used to being in a larger school, and I wasn't used to having so much attention from the teachers. Like when you're not doing your work and you're not on top of everything, the teachers are on your back.
And now you're seeking them out.
Yes, because I need all the help that I can get.
Our visit to Tech Boston Academy is tomorrow. As always, we welcome your thoughts on schools or anything on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Bush administration may be considering another controversial way of shoring up Social Security. The Boston Globe reports this week that the White House may propose ending the exemption from Social Security taxes for state and local public employees who have retirement plans through public pensions. Right now, public employees can opt into Social Security if they want, but they often choose not to because benefits paid by public pension plans are usually higher than those paid by Social Security. Tom Luthier represents the Coalition to Preserve Retirement Security, a group that wants to keep public employees' participation in Social Security voluntary. He spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes.
Give us some background, Tom. First of all, why are public employees exempt from paying into the Social Security system?
Well, it actually, Bob, goes way back to the beginning of the Social Security system. Most of the public pension plans that remain outside of the Social Security system predate Social Security, many by many years. And when Social Security was initially created, public plans or public employees were actually excluded from the Social Security system. They were not allowed to be part of the Social Security system. So what you see is, A, you have some plans that existed before that, and then you have plans that were built when they were not allowed, that were built based on the premise that these pensions were going to need to not only be a pension plan for the individual, but also, in effect, take the place of Social Security. It wasn't until many, many years later that first plans were allowed to opt in. When they were first allowed to opt in, they were also then allowed to opt out. Some came in and went out. And then the law was changed thereafter to preclude anyone that came in from leaving. So it's actually they're out because it was designed that way.
And now tell us why most people involved with public pension plans don't like the idea of forcing public employees into the Social Security system.
The problem for most is a very fundamental matter of cost. If you make the assumption that these plans have been built to meet the pension needs of their employees, and they're funded accordingly, obviously the employer is paying and the employee is paying, if you were now to say, oh, by the way, we've changed our mind, we're going to put Social Security on top of that, the system just breaks. Most cities and towns and states who are outside of Social Security and most of the employees themselves could never afford to absorb having Social Security put on top of what they currently have.
In other words, they couldn't afford to pay into both plans?
They couldn't afford both plans. It would break states. It would break cities. It would just not work. So our fear, of course, is that were that to happen, then the plans that have been working well in some cases for 70 and 80 years would ultimately need to be destroyed in order to accommodate this addition of Social Security.
You think they might have to be folded into Social Security in some way?
No, we think they'd have to be abandoned in many cases. The state governments or the local governments, whoever is this plan sponsor, if Social Security was mandated onto them, would have no alternative but to abandon their existing plan for the folks who are mandated into Social Security. Now, the problem with that is that in most cases, that means that the cost for the local government will be higher and the benefit to the employee will be less. So it's a lose-lose at the state and local level.
What about the argument that public employees might have more control over their money than they do now if they opted into the president's private Social Security account plan?
Well, would they have more control? Arguably, yes. However, if you take a look at the states where that kind of choice has been offered, most will opt not to have that kind of control. Most public employees understand what they know and what they don't know, which is the weakness of the president's plan. Public employees who are firefighters are good firefighters. They're good police officers. They're good teachers. They're not a good investment managers. So they're more than happy when given the choice, and they've been given the choice in many states. Given the choice, overwhelmingly, they will choose to leave their funds in the state plan where their risk is shared with all the participants in the plan and where the risk is also shared with the employer, who has an obligation, in our view, to bear some of that burden. I just think that it's a very fundamental. There's this belief out there that everybody wants to manage their own retirement benefit, and I think what you're seeing in the pushback that the president's getting is that's not as true as people think. And quite frankly, from a slightly paternalistic point of view, we as a society be better off if we didn't put everyone's retirement security into everyone's own hands.
There is a certain irony, though, don't you think, in that many of the critics of the president's private account plan worry about money, retirement money, being invested in the volatile stock market when, at the same time, percentage-wise, there's a much greater investment in the stock market in public retirement funds.
Yeah, well, if you look at it in its most simplistic form, there's an irony. But clearly, there's a huge difference, and it's a fundamental difference that should be clear to anybody who thinks about it. There's the difference between one individual having his or her entire retirement security dependent upon his or her own individual stock-picking ability versus having one's retirement security based upon a pooled risk, perhaps with thousands, hundreds of thousands, in some cases a million other people, with certain guarantees. What we're saying is that the kind of pension plans that the public sector operates pool risk, get very effective investment returns for very low cost because of the size and magnitude of the portfolios. And in the end, everybody wins, including, by the way, the taxpayers, more often than not.
So I'm wondering, as you travel the corridors of Capitol Hill, talking to lawmakers and their staffs about this rewrite or possible rewrite of Social Security, do you suggest that instead of the idea that the White House is floating, perhaps the Social Security rewriters ought to take a look at the way state public retirement plans are run?
We've not only suggested that. Many of them have asked us whether or not we think it makes sense. We have said, and not, by the way, the coalition that opposes mandatory Social Security coverage, we're kind of far afield from their agenda. Their agenda is very narrow. Stay out of Social Security. It's not in our best interest. Doesn't fix Social Security. Other public pension organizations, however, have said for years that the federal government and the Social Security system should look at the model that's worked in the public sector at the state and local level, and that they would clearly see a model that's working. Let me just give you one example, and I think it sums it up. In most plans, if you took a look at most plans around the country, somewhere in the vicinity of 75% of the value of the benefit received by those employees when they retire, 75% of the benefit has been paid for by investment income, not by employee contributions or by employer contributions. 75% investment income. Now, anybody, that any taxpayer, any employee, any employer would be happy with that return. And you certainly can't say that about the Social Security system.
Tom Lucier represents the Coalition to Preserve Retirement Security, a group working to keep public employees' participation in Social Security optional. He spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes. You're listening to Here and Now. The city of Philadelphia is going high-tech, turning the entire metropolis into a giant Wi-Fi or wireless fidelity hotspot. This means that anyone with a computer that has a wireless card can access the internet anywhere in the 135-square-mile city. The service is causing controversy because it would be in direct competition with commercial high-speed internet service providers such as Comcast Cable and Verizon. So joining us to talk about Wireless Philadelphia is Diana Neff. She's the city's chief information officer. And Diana, explain to us, we understand there's going to be wireless antennas throughout the city?
Yes. The city will use its assets, our light poles, on which the radio antennas will be mounted. Mm-hmm. We estimate that there will be about 3,500 to 4,000 devices that will be mounted across the city, about 18 antennas per square mile.
Mm-hmm.
And that will provide the airwaves, the wireless connectivity that people will be able to log in through a password and identification.
Right, so this service would be free. You can wander into a public park or into a square or sit on a park bench and use your computer. And would people also be able to log on from inside their homes?
For a fee. There will be free access in our public spaces, like you mentioned, in our parks and our squares. But if you want the signal to come into your home, it will be a subscriber base.
We understand $15 to $25 a month, about half the price of commercial high-speed internet services. Well, how would this benefit the city of Philadelphia?
Well, we're looking to spur economic development in our low-income and disadvantaged neighborhoods to help overcome the digital divide. And we do estimate that as many as 3,000 new jobs will be created and potentially 3,000 indirect jobs from just additional free cash flow that is generated from lower telecommunications costs.
We understand, you know, people just working daily, driving trucks in police cars can use it.
Absolutely. That's the beauty of this network, so that you can, whether you're a small service delivery company, have your individuals on bicycles or in cars be able to communicate back with the office to get instructions and directions.
We're reading that the police can download mugshots from their cars and truck drivers can check inventories as they drive around.
Absolutely.
Right. Well, as you well know, about 50 other local governments are also trying to create wireless zones. But the telecommunications industry is concerned about this because they see it as competition. Nearly 20 state legislatures have either passed or are considering laws that would ban local governments from offering telecommunications services. Pennsylvania has a law restricting local governments from setting up a service, but Philly won an exemption. And industry people are saying you're using taxpayer money to fund a project that competes with their private industry. Do you have an unfair advantage?
No, it's an assumption. We are not using taxpayer dollars. So we will have either through taxable bonds, through bank loans, or through foundations, the money to build the network. And then we'll repay those loans through revenue generated by people subscribing to the network. We're going to be using public assets, the light poles, to deliver a service that our community has said is important to them, and then using the private sector to build and maintain the network and to participate on the service delivery.
Do you worry at all that you might be eliminating jobs from, let's say, Comcast, which is heavily present in Philadelphia, because you'll be doing the wireless installation that they used to do?
No, we looked at that closely. We also looked at the market studies that show that in DSL and Comcast or cable customers, that really only, about 25% of that group chase prices. They are a subscriber because they want other things like video, email, or bundling services that we're not looking to compete in. In fact, we think it's an opportunity for companies like Comcast to work with the city to use the network to offer this roaming capability to their customers.
So the city of Philadelphia is the city of brotherly love is getting wired.
Yes.
Diana Neff, Chief Information Officer for Philadelphia, thanks for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Zip-a-dee-doo-da, zip-a-dee-ay. My, oh my, what a wonderful day.
With its combination of animation and live actors, the Disney film Song of the South became an instant classic on its release in 1946. Its signature tune, Zippity-Doo-Da, won an Academy Award, and an honorary Oscar went to actor James Baskett for what the Academy said was his heartwarming characterization of Uncle Remus, friend and storyteller to the children of the world.
I didn't know it at the time, but Br'er Rabbit was heading straight for trouble. 'Cause up on Chickapin Hill, at the edge of the big woods, old Brer Fox was powerful curious about the whereabouts of Brer Rabbit.
But Song of the South remains Disney's most controversial film. Its last theatrical release was in 1986. Disney withdrew the film from worldwide video distribution in 2001, and the film has never been released on home video in the United States. Joining us in the studio with some thoughts is Here and Now's pop culture critic and Boston Globe reviewer, Renee Graham. Welcome, Renee.
Hey, Robin.
Now, I'm guessing when I saw this film decades ago, as a young white girl in the suburbs, and when you saw it as a young black girl, I'm guessing during the 60s?
70s.
70s. Mm-hmm. It was a different viewing experience. What was your thought when you saw it, when you first saw it, that you remember?
I was probably about 9 years old, and, you know, I saw lots of Disney movies, and I remember just having sort of a strange, uncomfortable feeling watching this movie. And I couldn't quite articulate. I can't say that I felt, you know, the film was racist. I was a kid, but it was something about the film didn't feel quite right to me. Yeah. And I remember sort of leaving and not having that sort of great Disney feeling I had, say, when I left The Jungle Book.
Well, let's remind people of what the story is about.
They're based on the stories of Joel Chandler Harris, stories that he heard before and during the Civil War from slaves. He was a white Southerner who lived in Georgia. And in the film, you have the Uncle Remus character who is, you know, still living on the plantation. This is post-slavery, but still on the plantation. He's telling stories about, you know, these wily animals and the details that these animals went through to these little white children.
And he is a very happy former slave who wants to stay on the plantation in this depiction.
The happiest former slave you'll ever see. Yeah.
Br'er Rabbit wait for the tar baby to say, "Fine, how are you?" But the tar baby, he don't say nothing, and Br'er Fox, he lay low. So, Br'er Rabbit tried again. How do you do? But the tar baby ain't say nothing. Then Br'er Rabbit scratch one ear with his off behind foot and low, he gonna find out why he can't get no answer. Then he says he,
"Whoa, what's the matter with you? I said howdy. Is you all in here? I said howdy."
But the tar baby, he don't say nothing. And Br'er Fox, he lay low.
Oh, I hope he works. I sure hope he do.
And we've done some online research, and there are people who interpret, let's say, Br'er Rabbit, the wily Br'er Rabbit, as being, in fact, the black character, the African-American,
sure,
who outwits, you know, the stupid fox.
Right.
Who has all the power.
I mean, there is that. I mean, these are stories that are, you know, probably, that date back probably to Africa. It's probably before the slave trade. And the stories were brought from Africa, you know, to America through the slave trade and were told to generation to generation. That's how Joel Chandler Harris learned these stories.
Right. Well, and why haven't we seen it?
Well, it's essentially been out of circulation for almost 20 years. What really changed for the film was it came out in 1946, as you mentioned, but by the 60s and during the Civil Rights era, there were a lot of African Americans who were uncomfortable with this film and just felt like, look, you know, I don't know that we need to have a film out there for children that makes slavery, even though slavery is never mentioned and the word slave is never mentioned, but it's clearly, you know, a post-slavery situation, that sort of makes the whole experience look like it was this sort of cheery, happy endeavor for the people who were slaves. And, you know, I think Disney was sensitive to that and sensitive to the criticism in the 1960s. And, you know, you start to see less and less of the film. Once we moved into the era of home video, I think a lot of people expected it to come out on VHS and now on DVD, but you cannot get it. It's never been released on tape or DVD in North America.
Which is why the version we've been playing some clips from, we had to purchase online from Taiwan.
Mm-hmm. And people who really want to find the film can find the film. What's interesting is that Disney officials have said that this is the most requested film. This is the film that fans are always saying that they really want. My guess is eventually Disney will release the film on DVD. But I think the mistake they've made is in holding the film out of circulation for so long, they've sort of built the film up so it's become this really sort of insidious thing in the minds of a lot of people who probably either haven't seen the film or haven't seen it in a very long time.
Well, let me ask you about that, because Disney has said they've never outright banned the film. They are keeping it in their vaults. There are website petitions urging Disney to release it on DVD. What are your thoughts on that?
I think the film should be released on DVD. I'm always uncomfortable when we get into these, we have these notions that, well, our republic is so fragile that a film will just knock us to our knees and won't be able to handle it. I say release the film, but if you're going to release the film, you have to release it with the kind of supplemental material that is going to address the controversy that's existed for the last almost 60 years now surrounding this film. You have to talk about why the film had been out of circulation, what the feelings were in the African-American community in the 1960s. In addition to having stories about Joel Chandler Harris and where these stories came from, I think you have to address it. I think to put the DVD out there and ignore what's going on for the last, especially the last 20 years, would be foolish. But I don't, even though I have my own problems with the film, I absolutely think it should be released on DVD.
So that future Rene Grahams of the world, little 9-year-olds watching it now, aren't just sitting there with that uncomfortable feeling and not knowing why.
Yeah, put the film out, but put it in some sort of historical context and understand what the film represents, why the film was problematic for a lot of people. Otherwise, it seems absurd for Disney to have held it out of circulation for so long, even though they've never officially banned it. But it feels like they've done their best to kind of ignore the fact that it exists.
Yeah. And I want to ask you, Renee, you know, again, I have this feeling when I hear Zippity Doo Dah, my, oh, my, what a feeling I get. I mean, I love that song. Do you, are there parts of the film that you would have liked to have loved but couldn't? I mean,
you know, speaking as an African-American, with my friend, Zippity Doo Dah means something entirely different. And when we express, when we sing that song, we're not really thinking, my, what a wonderful day. So I guess it's all about, you know, context, background, you know, where you're from. But I mean, but that's the thing, you know, put the film out there and let the generations now make their own decisions about that. But let them also understand why the film was controversial. Otherwise, it's pointless. If they're not going to do that, then they might as well just leave it in the vaults. But I think leaving it in the vaults just makes it into this monstrous thing. It's almost like they're treating this film as if it were Birth of a Nation, which is the 1915 D.W. Griffin film, which was so insidiously racist that it actually led to increased enrollment for the Ku Klux Klan.
Right. You're saying Song of the South is not that.
It's not that. It's not even Gone with the Wind. But it's a film that is a bit vexing and controversial, and I don't think they're doing anyone any favors by holding it in the vault.
Here now is pop culture critic Renee Grahams talking about the Disney film Song of the South, which she would like to see released on DVD with educational materials. Renee, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Yes, sir. Zip-a-dee-doo-dah. Zippity-yay. My, oh my, what a wonderful day.
Oh, plenty of sunshine in the wind. Zippity-yay.
And this note, there are internet rumors that Disney may release Song of the South on the film's 60th anniversary next year. But a former head of Disney Feature Animation says the film has been placed on permanent moratorium. We'll see. It becomes public domain in 2039, and if Disney doesn't re-release it before then, it will lose the copyright. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
Mr. Bluebird's on my shoulder. It's the truth. Mm-hmm. It's actual. Mm-hmm. Everything is satisfactual. Zip-a-dee-doo-dah, zip-a-dee-ay. Wonderful feeling, feeling this way.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.